Welcome to the Hobcast Book Show, a weekly podcast from Hobeck Books, an independent publisher of thrillers, crime, mystery, and suspense novels. Each week, we'll take you behind the scenes of what we do, the challenges and the triumphs, the bumps and troughs of running a creative business in this challenging world. We'll hear from the people who make this possible, the authors, the cover designers and editors, and we'll have expert insights from our guest star interviews. Nothing is off the agenda on the Hobcast Book Show from Hobeck Books, as we combine trad values and an indie spirit.
Hello.
And welcome to the Hobcast Book Show, episode number 170. My name is Adrian Hobart.
And my name is Rebecca Collins.
And together we run Hobeck Books, UK independent publishers, of the following four genres.
Mysteries.
Suspense.
Crime.
And thrillers. Welcome to the show. And our guest this week is Dr. Luke Deckard.
There's a doctor in the house.
There is a doctor, and he's a fantastic author, and also really interesting story from Luke. Over from the States, lives in the UK, just got his PhD. But the main thing is he also has dyslexia. So we talk a lot about how he gets around that and wanting to work in words.
Yes, and I mean, he's quite active on Twitter. So I follow him and notice, you know, he's got some very interesting ideas and thoughts about the publishing world and creative writing. And
he's a really good podcaster as well.
Yeah,
We'll talk about that a little bit later. So Dr. Luke Deckard, our guest this week. It's awards season.
It does feel like that, yeah. I mean, there's loads of it about.
So our news really is focused on that. Just a few hours ago or overnight, the CWA, the Crime Writers Association of the UK, have announced their long lists for a plethora of awards.
Yes, it was last night, so I spotted it just before I went to bed. And I must admit, I'm not going to lie, there was a little bit of excitement as I flicked through the,
list. We had a couple of authors in for awards, and sadly they haven't been longlisted on this occasion.
No, so I went to bed in a bit of a grump.
Were really grumpy last night. You were really... It really gets to you, doesn't it?
It really does. I don't know why. I feel myself tearing up now. It's really silly.
So
I just feel for them. Yeah. I just want the best for them. Anyway.
Commiserations to Mark Whiteman and to Anthony Dunford.
Particularly, yeah.
Yeah.
So,
Let's just look at the Gold Dagger, which is the big one, the main event. And, the chairman of the CWA has a book on the list, Vaseem Khan.
Yeah, well done to Vaseem.
No, Vaseem, you know, deserves it as an author, you know, quite apart from his brilliant stewardship of the organisation. But we're delighted to see that J.G. Kelly is on that list. And
lovely man.
You'll remember from an earlier episode, he came on and talked about his book, The White Lie, which was a sort of mixture of historical and speculative fiction, set in Antarctic, Robert Falcon Scott's ill-fated expedition to the South Pole.
Interesting. When I read that, I thought, oh, that's a competitor for Mark Whiteman. I knew they'd be going for the same daggers because, they're both historical.
But he's in the gold list, so that's fantastic. Other, you know, names that we would have heard of, Mick Herron in there for The Secret Hours. And then after that, it's quite a fresh list, I think, for the Gold Dagger.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard of Kate Morton.
Yes,
But, I mean, you know, it's fantastic. And I'm happy for everybody, despite my own slight misery last night. It's a lovely opportunity. And I remember this time last year, Hobeck author Julie Anderson was on the long list for her one of her thrillers, the third in her trilogy. And, you know, even though we were just in talks at that stage. I was thrilled that we had a connection.
Now, I've got a question here because I'm looking at the Ian Fleming Steel Dagger, which is for thrillers.
Okay.
Specifically.
Let me just get that one up. Yeah.
There's an awful lot of Americans on that list.
TJ Newman, I think, is American.
Well, look, I mean, Linwood Barclay.
Of course, yeah.
David Baldacci.
Oh, right.
Doesn't really need the plug, one would argue. Is there S.A. Cosby? another really big American author.
Oh, okay, I don't know that.
And Karin Slaughter.
I would argue that Kotaro Isaka is probably Japanese.
Well, probably, but interesting. So, yeah, that's quite an international
list.
They're
quite big names, aren't they, actually?
Yeah, they're huge names. Yeah.
Interesting. Okay.
Right. So that's. Let's have a look at the historical list. I'm trying to get that up. It's on the. Have you got it?
Yes.
You do. Very good.
Historical list.
A bit quicker. So I need to scroll in a bit because my eyesight is shocking at the moment.
Look at that. It's like old person's view.
Anyone we recognise on that list? This is the long list we ought to stress.
No.
And this will get.
Oh, well, of course, John
down.
Banville.
Oh, John Banville. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Australian author, right?
I actually don't know, but his books are brilliant. They are really, really good.
Yeah. Okay. So, interesting. Well, no one really standing out there for me.
That looks familiar, but I don't know why.
What, Viper's Dream by Jake Lamar?
I think I've come across that.
Yes. That's.
I mean, a great collection. So, you know, we were fighting a lot of competition to get even that far. So.
And I think from a cover point of view, it's really good to keep these...
Oh, yeah.
These handy. So we're going to take screenshots of this so that we've got an idea of where things are going with covers. But there's some brilliant depth to these covers.
Yeah, but they're not commercial covers, are they?
No, they're not. They're definitely the literary end. Mm. And these are designed to sit in the bookshop shelves of Waterstones as opposed to appealing to a digital audience.
Yeah. I mean, there's also a publisher category. I don't know if you're aware of
that.
But I think... publishers get nominated as opposed to you put yourself up there.
Oh, right, okay.
And yes, unfortunately, we're not on the publisher long list. But Joffe Books are there. So
yes, I think they
them.
Were last year, weren't they?
Yes.
Okay. Well, look, I mean, we'll skip over that. If you want to look up the details, the CWA will eventually put up the list on their website. They hadn't by this point. It's on social media.
Well, we couldn't find it, but yes, on Twitter. If you look at...
It's not in their news section anyway.
Yeah, if you look at their Twitter feed, you'll see...
Anyway, well, look, you know, at least we don't have to put in our, you know, our pretend not disappointed face on the night, which we did, what, 2-3 years ago.
Well, you did. You went down.
Yeah,
you?
I did. Yeah, yeah.
But, you know.
Boy, was it hot in that room.
There's always next year.
There is.
We just have to remain optimistic.
Yes, and, you know, we can strive again and battle on. So the other big awards listing... is the National Book Awards, a.k.a. the Nibbies.
Yes, so...
And you came rushing in to me. Well, I was working on on a project on the computer, and you came in and goes, you're going to love this story. And I said, what? Well, you explain why you thought I would love this particular story.
Well, okay, so the Nibbies cover just publishing in general, don't they? So they're not specific to crime or anything like that. And there's a number of awards for books. So we put ourselves up for the Small Press Awards, as we talked about a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
But you can also nominate books. And there's a number of criteria that they take when they're judging the books. Part of it is commercial success, but that's not all of it. It's also about quality of writing. And so I saw that they'd announced a shortlist of the non-fiction narrative. And I thought, oh, interesting, because I... do work in nonfiction when I'm not doing Hobeck.
Mm. Yeah.
And I actually laughed out loud when I saw that Prince Harry's book Spare was on the shortlist of non-fiction narrative.
That's Prince Harry's ghost-written autobiography, Spare.
Yes. So you did point out very fairly, you said, well, it's one of the best ghostwriters around.
Well, it's certainly the highest paid ghostwriter in the world. Was hired for this and was paid an absolute fortune.
That's fine. So they should have a category for non-fiction ghost, or just ghost written.
Yes. I mean, it's very rare for a celebrity to write their own book nowadays.
Well, also on this list, so I'd like to tell you who else is on this list. Britney Spears, The Woman in Me. Now, do you think that was written by Britney Spears? I have no idea. I don't know.
I think it's been praised for being very authentically in the voice of Britney Spears. that is to say, I think it probably was ghostwritten, but whoever did the ghostwriting really captured the voice. And her story is, you know, I mean, Harry's life was touched by tragedy, but also enormous privilege, whereas hers is a rags-to-riches story, but with an awful lot of abuse along the way, particularly within her own family. And it's quite a powerful story, allegedly. I mean, I haven't read it.
Well, but... I'm not disputing that, but I'm questioning whether it's...
Well, okay.
It's...
Look, here's my problem with the Nibbies is that they've got as much value, I think. They're becoming such a populist awards ceremony in realistically, in terms of, you know, if it sells, it wins kind of thing, that... They're as valuable in the TV industry as the National Television Awards, which is a joke, where ITV win every category, apart from EastEnders once or twice, have won it, or The Repair Shop. Everything else goes to Ant and Dec or This Morning. It basically is a lockout for ITV. It's shown on ITV. It's an opportunity to get as many familiar faces in the rows of wherever they hold it. I think it's the Albert Hall or... might even be the O2. I mean, it's a big venue wherever they hold it. And it is just chock-a-block with, you know, your household favourites. And it has no intrinsic value because Ant and Dec's won every presenter award for, I don't know, is it 20 years now? Something like that. Straight. And the Nibbies feels that way, you know, really.
I don't know because I don't know anything about television awards, but it does... baffle me about the criteria. So there are other books on here which I think are probably worthy. Rory Stewart, as we spoke about him, he's probably a very good writer. He's very eloquent.
He's now the Chancellor of Oxford University.
Yeah.
He's a remarkable bloke for a Tory, for an ex-Tory minister. And better known, probably best known now for co-presenting The Rest Is Politics with Alistair Campbell, which is an absolute runaway smash podcast internationally. They're actually on tour in October, I think it is, in the United States, selling out arenas.
And
they're
also
so popular.
Also, Philippa Gregory, Normal Women, which I hope will win, because that is the only one I would say is proper quality narrative nonfiction.
Well, okay, look, I mean, they're going to hope that one of the named... big names shows up for this awards to give it a bit of glamour and gloss. It's unlikely it's going to be Harry.
Imagine.
Well, he might turn up. You're right. He might actually do that. But then again, you know, who's going to pay for security? And then Brittany's unlikely to show up. You'd say Rory will turn up.
Stephen Bartlett probably will.
Stephen Bartlett certainly will.
I don't know who Kevin Sinfield is.
Kevin Sinfield is a former rugby league player who is affected by... motor neuron disease,
okay.
Or ALS, and has been doing some heroic charity walks and fundraising.
And he's also written about
despite his disability.
Them.
Yeah, you know, he's sort of a big, you know, he's one of the biggest stars in British Rugby League
ever.
And but his illness, you know, his problems have made him an absolute national treasure within sporting circles.
Okay, so, you know, maybe it's nice he's on the list too then, but is it well written? I don't know.
Well, again, it's bound to be ghostwritten. But, you know, that's most of these things are written. And, you know, actually one of these days we'll get my friend Tony on because he's a prolific ghostwriter and has written some, you know, ghostwritten some amazing autobiographies and biographies. Some really interesting characters.
Oh, so I think we do need him on the podcast then, because that's interesting that we haven't had a ghostwriter. Oh, well, we had a coach stroke ghostwriter.
Yes, yeah, look, you know, it is...
They're unsung heroes.
Well, we're conflicted, I think, about these nominations, aren't we?
I'd like to see the criteria for judging, actually.
Well, I mean, you know, they're so elusive, aren't they? But, you know... people listening to, you know, our listeners will be thinking, oh well, they're just bitter they didn't get into the CWAs.
Well, no, this came first anyway. This came first, and also we don't publish non-fiction narrative, so
no,
this is a personal
issue absolutely.
I have.
Absolutely right. No. Well, that sort of wraps up our news section. We've steered clear of AI for we give you a break from that. Although I will say that. I was on one of my rare forays into LinkedIn the last couple of days. I rarely use it. And I was approached by an AI company to become one of their, at some sort of measly hourly rate, I don't know how you would describe it, but basically feeding the beast or grading the beast. So it produced sex, and I have to go through it and judge it for its quality. Teaching the large language models, and as you can imagine, I'm not in a rush to do that kind of thing. Money would be nice if it was better paid, but certainly not prepared to accelerate the process any further than we can avoid it. Really. Anyway, let's get to our interview with Dr. Luke Deckard. Now, we were on his show. We recorded it in December and it appeared on February, and had a really big impact. Actually, a lot of people listened to it. And we were very honest about the whole challenges of running a publishing house. Well, we are on this show too, but I think it gave us an opportunity to reflect and really express what, you know, the challenges have been. We've been going over 4 years now. God, it's rattled by, hasn't it? I don't know. I mean, I appreciate, you know, we're both working on it every day, but you work on so much of the stuff that is unglamorous, should we put it that way? And there's an awful lot of it.
Oh, there's a lot of unglamour, as you say.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of behind the scenes. So,
but then you get, you know, you get a day like this week where we launched Edge of the Land by Malcolm Holling Drake, and one of our best pre-sales ever. You know, a really good day sales,
and some fantastic reviews, like.
Yeah, amazing, on the blog tour. Brilliant. So, you know, check it out. Third in the Merseyside Crime Series. But, you know, that's a day when you know, you can feel uplifted.
Yeah.
But getting days like that is really hard. And, you know, we've gone past the point where it's all new. So, you know, it is, we're in for the long term, but it's a lot of grind too. But anyway, I digress. I mean, we talked about all of those things. It was our opportunity to have him on the show. And as we expressed, he's something of a polymath, really, with all sorts of interests. He has two podcasts on the go, one that's just starting up, which is dealing with noir, whether it's film or writing. And that's the style in which he writes, too, and that appeals to him.
I can't wait to read his first book.
Absolutely. So he's been picked up by a publisher. We don't know much more than that.
No.
We'll delve into it. But the thing to pick up from this is, yeah, someone's passion for language and for words, and yet someone with profound dyslexia. How do you become a writer working against that? And, you know, it's by no means a unique story, but nonetheless it's fascinating. But it's always a pleasure to speak to Dr. Luke Deckard. It's so fantastic to speak to Dr. Luke Deckard.
Dr. Luke Deckard.
Yeah, we love that.
I love it too.
And this is a return fixture. So welcome to the show. Thank you for inviting us onto the Secret Circle before, which had an enormous reaction. We had so many people coming through and saying lovely things and listening to that show. So thank you for the opportunity. Yeah. And it's lovely to speak to you now.
Yeah, it was my pleasure to have you on. And yeah, I had a lot of people who were really, really thrilled to listen to our conversation about all sorts of stuff. I'm also really happy to be chatting with you on your podcast.
Well, look, it's you know, we love doing this and having an established relationship in the sense, and we were listening back to some of it this morning actually and just reminding ourselves of the sort of vibe that we had, the three of us.
No, it's funny because I said, oh, I'd forgotten all about that, because you do, don't you? You forget quite quickly, I think, when
Yes. Well, it was a couple of months between recording it and it going out, so yes. There's that factor. So we're actually taking, it's a time capsule from December of last year, really, although it was published in February. And it's funny hearing ourselves and some of the things we were saying, and we were rolling our eyes and going, well, we don't think that anymore.
I said to Adrian, so he was playing it and there was one bit and I said, oh, you were feeling quite optimistic in December.
which bit was it? I can't remember. What was it?
It was talking about printing more books.
Going into print runs.
Yeah.
Because we kind of had a volte-face on that in a way, and said to ourselves, you know, it's the thing about printing print runs is that if you do short print runs, you type a lot of money, but you don't actually have a lot of product at the end of it. Mm-hmm. And this is something that's going to come out in our next podcast with Stuart from SRL Publishing, who is a big advocate on, you know, stopping the mega print runs because of the economies of scale, which is what most major publishers do. They print more than they need, and they know that there's a way of, you know, they're going to lose some money on things being pulped. But with 70 million books in the UK alone pulped each year.
Yeah, apparently.
You know, that overspend has got to stop. And so it's really beholden on publishers and indeed the print side of the industry to stop incentivizing printing more than you need. Which it's kind of crazy. So we kind of a little bit agnostic about print runs right now. And I think that, you know, print on demand is getting better.
Yeah. The quality gap is closing, isn't it?
Once that closes, then there really isn't a need to do the print runs and take the risk.
Yeah. I totally agree. I mean, I can't tell you how many books I'm buying nowadays that are totally print on demand. And it just makes sense. I mean, who is it? Thomas Mercer, who's the Amazon publisher.
Yeah.
Everyone who's with him is, that's automatically what it is. It's just the print on demand stuff. You can tell from the feel of it and stuff like that, but it mostly looks very, very comparable to most traditional, well, they are traditional publisher, but most traditionally published books, they look really comparable and they feel mostly comparable. But yeah, it's not going to be long before it's indistinguishable. I agree.
Yeah. And I think that's a good thing because, you know, what is the point of printing thousands of copies that just simply get pulped at the end of it? Yeah. That's a lot of trees that you've sacrificed and an awful lot of chemicals used in the process. So,
it's efficiency as well, isn't it? If somebody wants something, then bing, you can just make it rather than way it is to do.
This is a sort of add on to the podcast that we gave you. So let's focus on you though. And we ought to say, you know, congratulations, Dr. Luke Deckard. And you have some news, which is very exciting. I mean, you can't give us all of the news, but nonetheless, the book you wrote for your thesis, for your doctorate, is going to get published.
It is, yeah. I'm really, really excited by this. There was a point in time where I was thinking, this is never going to happen. But then you kind of do one of those like last ditch submissions, and then that just happens to be the one that's like, we like it, let's go. So I'm really happy that the novel for my thesis was titled Wasteland. It will have a different title when it comes out, but my thesis is titled Wasteland. But it's like a 1920s noir thriller. I personally think it's pretty cool. Hopefully other people will think it's cool. I never really like saying it's X meets X. I absolutely hate that stuff. Really gets under my skin because sometimes it doesn't make any sense. But yeah, so I never say that it's that kind of thing. But I will say, if you're a fan of people like Walter Mosley or Philip Kerr, those, it's kind of in that realm of detective fiction. So I think fans of that will hopefully take well to this, and maybe Robbie Morrison. It's sort of in that vein.
I mean, because it was Bloody Scotland, so one of our authors was longlisted for the McIlvany.
Ooh,
and
nice.
It was the same time as Robbie was, so yeah, you've got a copy of
Robbie won the debut prize at Bloody Scotland, which indeed Mark Whiteman was shortlisted.
He was shortlisted for that,
alongside him. So they did a panel together, and we got to meet Robbie. And you know, it's terrific to see. I mean, in his case, an author who's cut his teeth as a, you know, in graphic novels and comics, you know, taking the storytelling skills into the novel format. And do you take inspiration from that? Because I think there are so many ways to come at story. But it's amazing how many people come from that background. J.D. Kirk's another one who have, you know, an expertise in that, and that condensed storytelling, then given life with more space to work, really can work, can't it?
It can. I'm also thinking of David Bishop, D.B. Bishop. Yeah. He did a bunch of like work with like Judge Dredd and stuff. Yeah, no, it's you know, there's not much difference, because I have dabbled in comics myself. In another life. But yeah, no, it is interesting though to work with such a confined space and try and tell a huge story in like 30 pages. You know, if we're talking like a typical comic book is about 30 pages. A graphic novel, obviously, you got, upwards of 50 to 100 pages or something like that. But it takes a unique skill to be able to do it on that condensed level. The way I view it is it's essentially writing a film script, really. It's, when you do your films, they composite all the shots that they want there to be. And that's basically what, for me, like what a comic book is. So it's kind of more etching into that like filmmaking territory and writing sharp and concise for that media. But once you can kind of take that into the novel, you're allowed to let things breathe a lot more. You can kind of go down roads and avenues that you might not be able to do with illustrations and stuff like that. So yeah, no, it doesn't surprise me that comic book artists or writers end up making really good novels because, the craft of storytelling is still the same, isn't it? You're still looking to have rich characters, have exciting moments, and build upon all that kind of stuff. So, but what it does do is it does help you to, I think with some of these artists who kind of go from one media to the other, you can see where they might have a slightly, I don't want to say better grasp, but there's less, maybe less waffling with some of their stuff because they know, and you can kind of feel it. They're like, this is the stuff that's important, and I'm not going to go on these crazy tangents and pad stuff out with a bunch of nonsense.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I mean,
Wait, it's like that every word has to earn its
but in
place.
a sense, that's the distillation that noir has as well, isn't it? I mean,
Yes.
the masters of noir.
They're not that long book. They're not very long, are they?
No, they
Most of
don't
them.
tend to be.
No, not
Everything's
at all.
pared
Like,
down.
yeah, your Raymond Chandler's, your Shel Hammett's, Robert B. Parker. I mean, his books are tiny. Yeah, no, noir fiction is typically short and sweet, or short and sour, I should say. But I like that. I've always been intimidated by really big books. It's probably because I'm dyslexic and it takes a lot more energy and time to get through really big stuff. So like I will never get through a Robert Galbraith book because it's 1,000 pages. It's just not going to happen for many reasons, but one of them being the length. But yeah, good noir is typically short and kind of to the point. There's, your short sentences. It's all developed from Ernest Hemingway's writing style, which his books were also very, very taut, as they like to say. But I think what I appreciate about that kind of style is, yeah, is it doesn't leave space for wasted space. Every scene has to matter in some way. And the other thing that's quite fun about some of the noir stuff is, you might go back and read a Raymond Chandler, and sometimes the plots don't really hold up. But the thing that makes those the most interesting is it's not necessarily the watertight mystery. It's the character and the moments and the journey along the way that make them the most fun, the most, the way people interact and respond to situations. Because I can't remember who it was who said it, like, noir fiction is the kind of the hard-boiled detective is basically someone who just goes around and shakes trees and sees what, to see what will fall. And, because they're not really following, it's not like a Sherlock Holmes kind of mystery where it's this kind of very intricate plot of da 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 da. It's sort of, okay, I'm gonna shake this, okay, well, this guy looks interesting, I'll follow him for a bit. Okay, that didn't lead anywhere. Maybe this person, okay, that led to a dead body. Oh, that's okay, and so I kind of like the sort of, I guess, voyeuristic aspect of noir fiction, the sort of sense of maybe sense of chaos, I guess. There's a little bit of sort of, you don't really know what's going to come around the corner with it. So yeah, it is one of my favorite types of crime fiction, if not my ultimate favorite kind. I tend to write in that style, in that wheelhouse the most.
Right, and you mentioned dyslexia because that made my alarm, not alarm bells. I mean, my ears pricked up, I should say. My headphones started to vibrate.
That
Which,
sounds quite violent.
no, because I think this is really. This is, I mean, we have talked about neurodiversity issues with other guests of ours, one or two of whom have also had dyslexia, and you know there are other things that come into play. So, in terms of your process, how do you work against it, or is it a superpower? Because it's something that you can use to your advantage.
Oh,
the old superpower thing.
Did you ever see that Shane Black movie, The Predator, a couple of years ago?
Right.
Where the plot of that very, and I love Shane Black. Like, he's done some really great movies, and I was excited for his version of Predator because he was in Predator, the first one with Arnold.
Yeah.
He was one of the cast. His version, his film that he directed was terrible. And one thing I hated about it, absolutely hated, is that one of the themes was that the Predator was, basically what we found out is that the Predator would go to different planets and sort of absorb the DNA of the, you know, the strongest, you know,
yeah,
you know, praise, you know, yeah.
The alpha members of society.
That's it. Yeah. And there was a really bizarre plot in that, in which one of the people that the predator was after was a neurodiverse individual, who I feel like, you know, from my perspective, I can never see it as a superpower, ever. I don't like it when people kind of go down that route with it, because it's, you know, it's a reality, and maybe it can be useful in some ways, and you might see things a little bit differently than another person who maybe doesn't have that, you know, will see things. But it does make life really difficult. You know, I struggled at, you know, I grew up in the States, and so I struggled in elementary and high school.
Yeah.
Struggled with reading quite a bit. Struggled with during my undergrad, because there was these little things I kept getting tripped up on that I couldn't quite see because my eyes couldn't see it. So it's like, you know, and my professors would say things like, oh, you know, he's, you know, yeah, you're really smart, you can really get this stuff, da, 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 da. But it's, yeah, if you don't, it's hard. So it's kind of like, yeah, I don't really see it as a, it doesn't help me. It's not a superpower that helps me write my stuff.
No.
So that kind of is something that's always in the background of my mind when I'm trying to plot. But what it does mean, because I'm aware of the issue that I have, it does mean that I try to be very focused on plot structure, because it can be really easy to descend into chaos. It can be easy to descend into just all these rabbit trails of ideas. But what it means for me is, it means I have to keep myself really focused on what needs to happen in this story, what needs to happen next. I think Val McDermott once said that she does the kind of the driving in the fog lights approach to plotting. I wouldn't be able to do that, because for me, I wouldn't, it would just lead me down to so many different things. I get so far away from what the original idea was that for me, that wouldn't work. So, you know, there might be other people who are able to kind of use, who you know, can kind of, you know, once they get a hold of their, you know, I don't know what to call it. I don't want to call it an ailment, but it's, you know, once they get a hold of you know, their, you know,
condition,
you know, whatever. Yeah. You know, maybe the other people have other ways of, they will have other ways of sort of.
Well, I it's funny, because I'm sitting here thinking, right, okay, because, you know, I've been diagnosed with attention deficit disorder. It's not that long ago, maybe, you know, 18 months ago or something like that, still not really getting any help for it.
Yeah.
So finding my way through it. And yet, you know, as a rebranding exercise, the neurodivergent community have come up with, you have a superpower, to try and reframe everything. And it's an absolute nightmare.
Yeah.
Because it trips you up every step of the way, no matter what you're trying to achieve in life, being attention deficit disorder. Only when you get your moments of hyper focus does, you know, and those are rare.
Yeah.
You know, it's not something that happens every day.
Help you find your keys.
No.
I'll tell you that.
Nope. Speaking of which, I lost the house keys last night.
I would choose to be able to find my keys.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. No. It's I get it. There's the people want to sort of they want to change the, I get the idea of wanting to sort of change the attitude and change the language
Yeah.
around something. But I do think at some point you get there does you there is a bit of a problem where you change things to a point of maybe lunacy, where it's like, this isn't really something. I would much rather not have this. I would rather not be dyslexic. Like, if I could change that, I would change that. It doesn't, you know what I mean? It's not, it's, and I feel like other people would probably, maybe they might not say it publicly, but I feel like other people might in private be willing, might say similar things of
Yeah, no, I
different
agree. I
conditions that they
think
have. I mean,
it's a way to make people to try and make people feel better. If
yes.
they say to you, you have a superpower, they hope that you might feel better.
Yes. But then when you try
It
and like,
doesn't.
fill a job application out or something like that, try and, you're doing your first university essay or whatever, like if you it there's I guess there's the idea that sometimes some of this stuff could be used as, you don't want it to be, you don't want it to be a crutch, I suppose. And I think it can be really easily manipulated into becoming a crutch, where it's like, I think like other people who have different sort of conditions, that you have to basically learn to survive alongside it. And that's really not easy at all. So which again, this is why it's like it's not a superpower. It's something you have to you have to sort of adapt
Yes.
to your circumstances. It's no different, not no different, but it's kind of similar to, if you we're all wearing glasses. If we weren't wearing glasses, we would be useless to society. I wouldn't be
My
able to see.
superpower.
Yeah, right. It's like I wouldn't be able to see. I wouldn't be able to get around. I wouldn't be able to write. I wouldn't be able to do anything, because without my glasses, everything is just totally blurry.
Yeah.
But
But
you, yeah.
I was going to say, I mean, it's interesting that then you're drawn, given the challenges in education throughout, that
You
dyslexia
are
has given
a
you, are Dr. Luke Deckard, and published author, and with a book deal on top of that. Why would you be attracted to something that is so challenging in the world of words?
Yeah, well, I guess that's the other thing. I guess you don't really, I guess when it comes to being, you have the condition of saying being dyslexic, but then you also have other talents that are just your talents. And I've always had, since I was a kid, I've always been in love with storytelling. I've always been in love with the craft and immersion of what story can do. And I remember my first sort of attempts at writing stories, and when I was a little kid, and all the way through to sort of, high school and things like that. Then I sort of paused for a while when I went to uni. Yeah, I think for me, it's one of those things where I've always been drawn to it and wanted to tell stories. And because I always understood their impact on people and why they're important. Whether that's when I was growing up watching things like Star Trek or reading Lord of the Rings or the Chronicles of Narnia or the old the Sherlock Holmes stories. You could There's something so powerful about storytelling that just pulled me in, and always wanted to be in that. I always wanted to be in that world, because I always felt I sort of understood story, more so than other people around me, growing up, that is. And as I grew up, I tried to find people that were kind of like-minded, and now I've a bunch of writer friends, and it's a lot of fun, because we can sit and talk about what works and what doesn't work, and how to make this better, or all that kind of stuff. So it's not a, well, I guess it's, maybe going back to the glasses thing, or the adapting thing. You have to, because you have the condition, it doesn't necessarily stop you from being able to participate. It
Yes.
just means that to participate, it's much harder for you than other people. Because the way, I think the way to sort of view it for me is, and I read this analogy a long time ago when I was first diagnosed, which wasn't that long ago. I was diagnosed, I think, in 2022, because I was struggling so much, and I was like, I think this might be it. I got tested, and the lady who did the testing was like, "You are hella dyslexic." And I was like, "Yeah, I sort of thought so."
Dyslexic plus, yeah.
Yes. You get an A plus.
Yeah, it was yeah. But one of the analogies that really worked when I was kind of, you know, doing research on it was you kind of look at, say, words on a page, view them as sort of bricks in a wall, right? So you don't, if you stand back and you look at the whole wall, it can be overwhelming, right? You're looking at the wall and you're trying to see, how is this wall made? It's too much. You have to focus and look at a single brick and do it one at a time to then build that picture up in your mind. And that's kind of what I've always had to do. And it was, I taught myself to do that without realizing that that's what I was doing. I would, you know, I couldn't just read a page of any book or whatever and instantly get it. It was like, okay, I need to read this bit. Now I need to think about what I just read, you know, this sentence, and then kind of build the picture up. And that's kind of always been my, I guess that's been my trick to sort of survive for all these years.
Yeah, I think that's true. It was weird. I'm thinking back to my own school days, and I had a very good friend of mine, Matthew Button, who was one of the first person I ever met who was, we knew was dyslexic and had been, you know, caught, you know, had basically been diagnosed.
Yeah.
And given that the school I was going to was a private school, fee paying, and one of the teachers, I remember this very vividly, told the class, well, Matthew will be, you know, we're going to change, he's got different homework because he's got a challenge. It's called dyslexia, and he's here as a teaching challenge for all of us, because and they actually took him on for that reason, because because you had to go through an entrance exam to get in this place.
Right.
And the poor bloke from that point on carried this, you know, you might as well have given him a bloody great label to carry around.
Yeah.
From there on in, you know, he's a teaching challenge. He was wonderfully gifted. His imagination was unburdened, frankly, you know, unyoked. Yeah. And he was practically, in a sense that the rest of us could not possibly imagine, he could build anything out of wood, age eight. And I remember him proudly showing me, when he took me to the back garden in his place in Cambridge. I don't know why I'm going down this road, but it's just a very vivid memory. And he said, I've been working, turning some wood, and he basically built the cockpit of a Messerschmitt 109.
Wow.
Aged eight.
Wow.
What's he doing now then?
He's in furniture, I think.
Okay. Well, there you go. He found his passion, which is good.
Yeah. But, you know, it just goes to show, I think, that, you know, people are aware of it now. But
if times have changed since when we were at school.
But definitely. Wouldn't it have been nice? Because I'm sure I've got dyscalculia, because I was hopeless at mathematics. And yeah, I come from a science family. I just couldn't cope with it at all. At no level could I understand it. And somehow I scraped through. But it was always the mightiest of great challenges and just misery.
Yeah, yeah.
Being held up as a dunce for maths when everybody around me were brilliant. And they're all professors at Oxford in science and stuff.
In those times, if you weren't very good at a subject, then, yeah, you were labelled as, you must be dim. You haven't got intelligence.
You're not applying yourself. That was the other thing. You're not applying yourself. God, you're not trying.
Yes. Yeah. Try harder. It's like, I'm trying as hard as I can.
Exactly. Well,
do you feel in a way you found your way through it, but do you look back on any of that with some resentment because it didn't get spotted or didn't get helped?
A little bit. Yes. Oh yeah, I do. There's little sort of, I guess that, you know, in hindsight, it's like, oh my God, how did you not see this? How did this not get picked up? But I mean, I'm a late 80s kid. Life was still very different for my generation. There was a lot of that sort of, we're kind of that last bit of generation of kind of late millennials who were still sort of under that like rogue, not rogue parenting, but that sort of like, you just get on with things, you know, you can go and do what you want and it's fine. Whereas I think kind of kids born kind of mid 90s on and onwards had much more pressure and control, and that was kind of very different for those kids. So yeah, I'm kind of from that kind of early era where it's like you kind of had that, you know, a little bit of nuttiness still. Not that the people in the 90s aren't nutty as well, but that's a different, that's a different conversation.
Well,
but
you know, yeah, we were just left to run foul. So.
Yeah. So no, there were moments where, you know, once I got it officially diagnosed, I was like, oh man, A, this makes things make way more sense. My whole life makes so much more sense now.
Yeah.
But definitely these moments where it's like, man, like people would tell me things, you know, there would be conversations about stuff where that I wasn't grasping something or having difficulty with X, Y, and Z, but no one was ever, we weren't getting to that point to say, you know, maybe get tested or maybe do this or maybe check that kind of thing. It just sort of just kept being that sort of, oh, well, you just need to learn. Oh, you just need to study harder. Oh, you just need to da, 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 da. And I'm like, I'm literally doing as best I can. You know, and that's, yeah. So yeah, I wouldn't say maybe resentment is a bit too harsh, but there's definitely bits of like, when I think back, I'm like, oh man, I don't know if it would have made life easier, but it would have been nice to have known earlier on. To, you know, and you know, then you kind of wonder how life would have progressed if you had been able to, you know, have this you know, this diagnosis at a very early age, and how that could have been affected it on a school level. But I mean, education on a whole is a totally different topic, not totally different, but it's a whole other topic. But you know, that's something that is constantly in need of reform and change. And you know, education in the 90s, you know, is wasn't super great in certain places, you know, and it's not great now either, but there are at least avenues to sort of be able to kind of maybe get some of this kind of stuff picked up earlier now than what there were back then.
Definitely.
I'm curious, I mean, given everything that we've talked about, so when you get the validation of something printed and published, is it sweeter now as a result of that, knowing that, you know, the challenges that sort of, or is the fact that, you know, being a writer and getting anything published is still a massive achievement regardless of
I think
yeah, I'm just, because you know, it is that thing you were talking about, how your New Deal came at the sort of back end of a whole load of submissions.
Yeah.
That whole, you know, the rejection process, and that feeling of someone's got me, and someone's, you know, I'm in good hands now.
Yeah.
So it is that still a feeling, or do you, I mean, you can, as a author, it's impossible to take things for granted, isn't it? Unless you are Ian Rankin, I would have thought.
Even Ian, I don't think Ian takes things for granted either, though. I think
no, to be fair to him, he doesn't, know.
Yeah, but I don't know. I mean, there was a moment when I finished my PhD, and I surprisingly, I shocked myself, and I passed without corrections.
Wow.
Which, you know, to have, you know, to have gone that far and then pass something like a PhD, and no, most people get corrections and not... Yeah. Having to have corrections was that was a real achievement for me, and quite just shocking, really. And so there was a little bit of sort of, you know, that was kind of a twofold, I guess, validation, where it was like there was this sense of like, in spite of this, I've, you know, managed to achieve something as great as this. But then also just that writer pride, you know, that academic pride of like, oh my gosh, yes, I was able to, you know, to achieve, you know, this high level of a degree that I've kind of always wanted since I was, you know, since I first started doing my, you know, when I went and started doing my undergrad a long time ago. I always wanted to do, you know, have a PhD and get there and but always sort of felt like I could manage it. I, you know, so I could manage an undergrad, but I don't know if I'm smarter for the next step. And then, you know, I took the next step and, you know, nailed a master's and then thought, well, maybe I could give this a go and stuff like that. But that was, you know, it's a long process. But no, I think, yeah, when it comes to like the publishing and thinking about, you know, the kind of gratification of it, I think it's kind of a mixture of both. It's like, wow, I'm really proud of myself, you know, that in spite of this, I've managed to finally achieve something like that. So it kind of comes with both. It's that sort of, yeah, in spite of, but also as a writer, thrilled at the same time.
I want to take, because you've been podcasting and talking to some really good guests over
like yourselves.
Well,
yeah, ourselves accepted, but a lot of terrific writers as well. You know, I get the sense that you're really on top of where storytelling is in the modern age at the moment. What's your, if we were to take, you know, Luke's health check of storytelling, Dr. Luke, what's your description? What's your diagnosis of the current state of storytelling in a world where we've got so many different things drawing people's attention at the moment?
The diagnosis is not good.
Right.
Oh, maybe we should be sitting down comfortably for this.
Yeah. I say that with a little bit of tongue in cheek. There are plenty of really great writers out there. There's plenty of really great novelists and comic book writers and script writers and TV writers. There are, I don't want this to sound like there's not, there are a lot of really good things out there. But I do think at the moment there is it's the most polite way of saying this. I think at the moment there are a lot of inexperienced writers producing stories that feel inauthentic.
Yeah.
That are either inauthentic feeling because they feel like they are imitations of copies. Originality is at an all-time low. And it's tricky because if someone's listening and be like, well, yeah, but you're talking about you write noir fiction. What's original about that? And the complicated thing is you can take a style. You can work within a genre. Whether that's, you know, you're working in noir or you're working in police procedural or you're working in psychological suspense, whatever. You can work in those styles and you can work with those tropes and try to produce something that is unique. But a lot of times what I'm finding now is I can pick up a couple of books, we'll say from the crime fiction shelf, and the style is almost indistinguishable from one author to another. And you're like, wow, this person could have easily have written that and vice versa, because I think at the moment we're kind of in a crisis of original voice. There aren't strong voices out there at the moment. They do break through. Some do genuinely break through. But you do see a lot of sameness. And I think a lot of that comes from, and this isn't just publishing, this is film and TV as well.
Yeah.
There's a fear of trying new things or fear of written, you know, the risk aversion is a really big thing, I think, in the creative industry in general. So I feel like the moment the quality of storytelling is probably, I don't want to be hyperbolic, but I feel like it's probably at an all-time low. Just because and this might be because the level of stuff, the sheer amount of books and TV shows that are coming out is sort of an unprecedented amount of for lack of a better word that I hate, but content. There's just so much content out there. And a lot of places consider their work, their art, they consider it content, which I think adds to the problem.
I think the worst thing that ever happened in the creative industries is when somebody stopped talking about, you know, in my case, in broadcasting, we stopped talking about programs. We just talked about content.
Yeah.
And I wince every time I hear people say that, you know, we've got to make some compelling content. It became commoditized. And that, you know, you would judge the value of a story about the impact it's going to have for you. In the BBC's case, in BBC Sports case, well, what is this? Is this story that you're doing going to appeal to a young audience? If it doesn't, we're not running it. If it's not something that we can bite size and stick a bunch of memes and GIFs and stuff around and stick it on Twitter, we're not doing it.
Yeah.
And once you start thinking in those terms, rather than creating something, you know, I came from a mixture of backgrounds in the sense of live broadcasting, but also long form, well thought out documentary making. And that was junked almost overnight.
Yeah.
And the podcast revolution has brought it back a little bit to a degree. But most of it is about, can we condense this and make it clickbait and appeal to an audience that's got a 10 second attention span?
Yeah.
And so the word content to me is the words, it's the word of the devil in creativity terms. It really is.
Like superpower.
Yes. Yeah,
and
kind
I
of
curse
yeah.
myself if ever I've written an email to an author from Hoback and said, yeah, this is really good content.
No, you've
I would never
done
do
that.
That.
You've never done that. But I think it's also because writers think they know what people want to read. And they think that people want to read the same stuff over and over and over again.
But yeah, we're in the genre fiction business. That's the trouble.
Yeah.
Is that actually, yeah, that stuff does sell. If you can, look, there are plenty of examples, and we've had, you know, there's a very famous example in recent months where one author's gone to ground recently, having built a reputation and a business writing books that are very similar to Lee Child's. let's be honest. And then someone went out there and looked at the text and actually found that the text was spookily similar to The Great Gatsby or...
Yeah, that's a bit bizarre, but...
and great classical works. And this has forced this particular author underground, one of the great sort of bastions of independent publishing in recent years. And so where I'm leading to this is that, you know, I think you're right in the sense that, you know, originality is very difficult to sustain when it is about, and sell. That's the thing. The selling element really works against the originality.
I will buy original books.
I know you do.
You're the only person.
No, you're not the only person.
No, I mean, a lot of people do. A lot of people will go for that. And you do sort of see you can kind of sense a slight shift in taste from the general public. I mean, the problem, I think one of the big problems, it's sort of with want of a better term, but the problem I think is always kind of sat with the gatekeepers more than the artists. And so there's all these sort of quality checks, quote unquote, that you have to kind of get through. Well, is this enough like this for it to sell? Okay. Yeah. This is enough like that for it to sell. Okay. Yeah. We'll go with that one, where then you have this, you know, people have said this for years, but like Star Wars would never get made today. in today's world, Star Wars, you know, the original would never get made because it's too risky. It's an unknown intellectual property. You know, there's no sort of, you know, built-in audience already. So that makes it already.
And it almost didn't get made. And if it hadn't been for Alan Ladd, recognizing what, you know, at the heart of it, it was, you know, George Lucas saying, right, you know, this is a reworking of a 1930s serialization, Buck Rogers or something like that. And it's that kind of thing that I'm trying to work with. And I'm going to take it to the, you know, way further forward. But at the same time, at its essence, Joseph Campbell's hero's journey is, you know, the Luke story. That's what that's all about. And, you know, there were so many elements that almost failed. The money. The technology, The acting, to some extent, the editing saved it.
The editing did save it. This is true. This is true.
And it, you know, if the music hadn't been right, if ILM hadn't solved all the problems they were having creating spaceships flying down a tunnel and all that stuff, then it would have been a flop. But at its essence, he had one thing that was right. It was something that spoke to the human condition.
Yeah.
And excited. It was exciting to watch.
Yeah.
But as you're right in saying, it wouldn't have got, it wouldn't get commissioned now.
So it's risky to be original. And in that case, it worked, but.
Yeah, which I mean, I'm not going to like toot my own horn here, but I do think one of the difficulties I think I've faced in my road to publishing is that I'm fully aware that both the genre and my protagonist are both sort of they're not really atypical at the moment. I mean, It's a little bit frustrating because you actually can see noir fiction's influence on so many things, whether it's the current TV shows or films or books. You're like, this is, you know, for example, like I mean Ian Rankin is heavily influenced by noir fiction. He uses a lot of noir tropes. Joseph Knox, his Adrian Waite's books, you know, those are very very noir in the way they're written and they come across. You know, one of the greatest superhero movies, Logan, the last Wolverine proper, you know, that is film noir to the core. So you it's still there. Or even the most recent Batman movie is 100%, you know, noir inspired. So you see it quite a bit, but you do sense a reluctancy from agents and publishers from time to time. I remember when I was still in Miller writing my PhD, I was kind of talking to an agent about my book. I was just not formally, we were just having a chat. And he grimaced. He was like, or winced rather, when I told him that it was, noir. He's like, I was like, what's the problem with that? You know, so, and it's because at the moment what sells, you know, traditionally at the moment isn't noir fiction, and fish out of water protagonist in a noir novel, it's an odd thing. I fully recognize that my book is you know, while it adheres quite nicely to the noir, does have a lot of odd things to it that you can kind of see someone be like, oh, but this is a little bit strange, how do we, what do we, you know, you can kind of, I can kind of see why there have been issues in the past, despite I think it being a good story. And I tell myself the fact that it was the basis of a PhD that was successful, you know, I know that it's a good story. You know, I know that there's something to it that is engaging and fun and things like that. But it's it does, you know, it at the moment, you know, we sit in a world that's very sort of super tick boxy. And if you don't meet that criteria, things can take a lot longer than what you would like. If I were to write a
procedural, but your explanations makes me want to read it.
Yeah,
you're welcome to read it.
we look forward to that. But you know, I'm sitting here squirming a little because, in a way, the ethos of Hoback when we started was to take a lot more risks than we currently take, because, you know, there's a commercial imperative that we need to sell some more books to keep this thing alive.
Well,
frankly,
yeah.
And so, you know, there's me saying, yeah, that cover doesn't say that genre to an Amazon scroller.
Yeah,
it doesn't immediately scream it. So we've got to change it.
Yeah,
even though we want to. And I feel guilty now. And it, but at the same time, you know, because we're the commissioners in a sense. But actually, we're not, because the market is commissioning us to think a certain way.
Yeah,
and this is the challenge. This is the constant challenge that we're all facing. That, you know, in an ideal world, our beautiful pearl that we, you know, that we've shined up beautifully and you know, worked on,
yeah,
would immediately find that audience and would live and by its own merits.
Yeah,
but that's not how the world works at the moment in terms of storytelling.
No. And I guess it's also complicated because it never fully has. I mean, I'm a big fan of the movie Blade Runner. That was a, you know, terrific failure. you know, that just didn't do very well. And even the sequel, when that came out, people thought, oh, this is going to be the big revival. But again, that one didn't do very well.
It flopped again, yeah.
Yeah, but they're still two great films in my opinion, and they both found their audience. They both they have their they you know they have their audience, and I think but I think the you know I don't have the solution to the problem, but I think one thing that could be helpful for the industry in general is to maybe not necessarily be so afraid to, you know, embrace certain genres. You know, there's, you know, when it comes to crime, particularly English crime, British crime, it is a lot of times it is, you know, barrister, you know, barrister protagonist with a, you know, a domestic problem that, you know, that goes a little haywire, or it can be, you know, or you get very, very cliched police procedural, upset, you know, DCI, DI McGregor, you know, has to solve this serial killer case in 5 minutes or the whole world's gonna blow up.
While falling out with their teenage son and la la la, you know, and
So
the
it's
dog's got distemper, you know, it's kind of, yeah.
yeah, and
Distemper.
I don't know.
I think it's like there's the thing is there's in my the way I see it is there's always room at the table. So at no point am I saying let's get rid of that, let's not do that, let's not do that. It's step back and say, actually, guys, don't underestimate the audience. You know, people will respond to good storytelling what if it's there, if it's in front of them. And I say Blade Runner, even though Blade Runner failed, it is now a cult classic. It is now a well-known film, you know, with multiple and multiple editions. It is now a success, right? 2049 still not a success, but Blade Runner is now a success. It found its place. It just took a long time. And sometimes that also happens. It doesn't necessarily overnight. I think we kind of want overnight success. And when that doesn't happen, yeah, I feel bad for authors who, you know, they get their one book. And they're super excited, and then it doesn't, you know, break numbers, and then their publisher's like, "We're not doing anymore," and you're like, "But why not?" You know, like some of our best known authors weren't overnight successes, and I think we kind of sort of expect that
Ian
now,
Rankin.
which makes things a bit
Mick
more.
Karen. Yeah, there's
Yeah,
lots
Mick.
of examples.
I mean, his books are terrific, but it took him a very long time, and it's like. And you just sort of you look at that, you read all his stuff, and you're like, how could someone like why would someone pass on this? Like, what is passable? And you know, and this is where I think we kind of get into the problem of taste. And because you hear that quite a bit. Oh, well, it didn't speak to me, or it's not really what I'm looking for, or da 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 da. And it's like, I hear you, I hear that, but like surely the understanding of the, you know, one's understanding of good storytelling and things like that should maybe be able to look past what you're specifically looking for and say, oh, this is actually a pretty fun story. I think this could probably, you know, find an audience. It might not have a massive audience, but it might have an audience for this kind of thing. And so I think there's just ways of reprogramming and rethinking, because I also think there are it within the industry there are people with outdated views. Someone who I won't make the connection really clear, but I know someone who knows someone who works within the publishing industry, and they're in the industry, and they still think that authors get big advances for every book that is taken on. And when my friend was telling them, no, like most like fiction authors, you know, get paid royalties. Like very few actually get, you know, big advances. They were adamant that's impossible. They even though they work in the industry, they were with this like Hollywood idea of how publishing works, where you can go buy a castle, you know, with your advance. And it's like, yeah, no. So I do think there is an element of maybe not re-education, but maybe just sort of better educating yourselves a little bit about, like, not yourselves as in you guys, but like certain agents and things like that could, you know, you kind of think, okay, well, yeah, you're very narrow in your thinking. Maybe you need to expand your thinking. Because I'll never forget someone who worked. I know someone who worked at a well-known publishing house who didn't actually know who Raymond Chandler was.
Wow.
I'm like, and they worked in a crime fiction department. They were a
Double
commissioner.
wow.
Yeah. And I was like, so you commission crime books, but you don't know who Raymond Chandler is. And they're like, no. I was like, wow.
That both surprises me and
Well,
doesn't
but
surprise
I,
me.
look, you'd be surprised just how often working in a sports department, people had complete, had never heard of Babe Ruth
Yeah.
or, Larry Bird or even
Yeah.
Magic Johnson,
Yeah.
and because they would come this because I worked on a world sports department. That was my big brief.
Yeah.
People who came from a domestic local radio background in the UK, and they knew the they could name the whole youth team at Stoke City, but they couldn't tell you, they couldn't make that expect, they couldn't do anything about baseball, basketball, or any of those, those American sports, because they just didn't, it didn't register with them. And
Yeah.
I used to find that was my test. If you don't know who the leading African athletes are, and you don't know who the current Super Bowl champions are, you don't work for me. It's as simple as that.
Yeah.
I think it's also in publishing. I think young people, when they graduate from their degrees and they think, I want to work in publishing because it's going to be a wonderful job. I'm going to get to work with books all day and I'm going to go out for lunches
I'm
and
gonna
go to parties.
hang with authors and
Yeah,
anyway.
actually, the
Yeah.
best editors are those who are passionate about the books. So not just passionate about books in general, but passionate about,
Yeah.
that. I mean, that was my experience because I was an
Definitely.
editor, but it was non-fiction. It was academic publishing. But the people I worked with who were the better editors were those who really cared about the books
Yeah.
themselves.
Yeah.
So.
Well, look, we ought to. I mean, we have covered some big subjects here. So,
We
yeah.
have. We've been all over the place.
And thank you for entertaining our bizarre questions. But it's been fantastic, Luke. But now it is time for, I dare say, you were waiting for this, Rebecca's random question.
Here we go.
Okay, before we started recording, we told you that we went to a gig last night. I actually
Yes.
went to a gig the night before as well, which never happens. I never go to two in a row.
Wow.
And so my question to you is, how far would you travel and for who would you travel? So who do you really want to see and how far would you go to see that person play live?
Okay. Who I really want to see, and this is because of multiple failed attempts to actually go and see them, is I really would love to see Blink 182.
Right.
I loved them growing up. I love them now. There's been a couple of times they've almost come or been close to London, and those shows have fallen through for whatever freaking reason. If I would go see Blink 182, and I would travel as in terms of distance, and this is complicated because they're technically gonna be at Reading, and I'm not a festival dude. I'm not gonna go to a festival, so it has to be like a proper show. Like
Yeah.
it has to. So this is my stipulation on this. I would travel pretty much anywhere within the UK, to see them with I think within most reason, like London, Birmingham, Edinburgh,
Yeah.
Manchester. If there was an accessible show, something like that, I would be willing to travel, 3 4 hours on a train and spend the night somewhere if I could actually see them.
Let's hope it happens.
One
Well,
day, one day.
the concert I saw the night before was the Bare Naked Ladies, and my middle son, who's 18, is a massive fan of the Bare Naked Ladies,
Cool.
to the extent that he plays them in the car on the way to school every day.
Nice.
And so I think he would have traveled to Canada. But
Wow.
luckily they came to Wolverhampton.
Hey, there you go. Yeah, I definitely wouldn't be traveling overseas. No way. No way.
No, I don't think I would, but yeah.
No. Most of the people I would want to see have passed on now.
Oh, you have to travel upwards then.
Yes.
You
Or
know, and
down.
I have tr well, I'll tell you the time I went to the greatest length for not actually to see them at all, but just to be somewhere near them, which was 1990. I travelled to, it was part of my world sort of tour before I went to university. I went to Minnesota and
Oh.
Minneapolis, and I stood outside Paisley Park Studios for 2 days
Who's that?
in February. Prince.
Oh.
Spent 2 days freezing my every aspect of my body,
Yep.
falling off with cold because it was about minus 15, standing outside what is outwardly a fairly bland looking building in the hope that I might get to see a glimpse of him.
And the irony is, I lived in Japan for 2 years, and there was one day when I was in Tower Records. I don't know if that
Yeah.
exists anymore, but
No.
there was a guy, quite a small guy, and some big burly guys, and I swear the small guy was Prince.
It
It
might
might
have
have been.
been. It might have
But I was
been.
didn't really know much about Prince at the time, and I just sort of kept this
Yeah.
memory in my head. And I said this to him. I said, "Oh, I was in Tower Records one Sunday afternoon in Tokyo, and I think Prince was there looking at CDs."
So wait, so did you not see Prince then when you were freezing your
No,
everything off?
I didn't get to see him at all. I mean, I got to see, there were certain locations where his music had emerged from, certain clubs and things like that. But no, or not on that occasion. I mean, before he died, I saw Prince probably 6 or 7 times live. And one very memorable occasion was when I was a member of the fan club, and so I went to see a big concert. And then they distributed amongst the those of us in the front rows tickets to go and see an afternight, a late night gig, which he would always do. This is the thing about Prince. He would do his big gig and he put everything into it. And you think, where's he? Where, he must be so exhausted, especially doing the splits around the stage for hours. And then he would do an afternight at 3 in the morning at the, I think it was the Lyceum or something like that, in Tottenham Court Road. We got to see him at 3 in the morning, get on stage, perform with Eric Clapton, Ronnie Wood, and Misha Paris. And it was a jam session. I mean, his band were amazing because they just followed. He had little cues. The way he wiggled his bottom would tell them to stop on the one. And just amazing to watch something like that. But the funny thing was, Clapton was a massive Prince fan. In fact, Clapton credits Prince and the Purple Rain movie for getting him back to playing the guitar because he'd given up in the mid 80s. He didn't want to know anymore. He was going through drug problems and all sorts of things. And he saw Purple Rain and said, right, I'm going to pick my guitar up again. So to see them together playing the blues was fantastic. But the beauty of it was Prince did this thing where he shook his bottom or whatever it was. The band stop. They all file off. Clapton takes the cue. Puts his guitar down, but Ronnie Wood, who was out of office, whatever, was still playing. And he carried on for about 5 minutes, not realizing the rest, everyone else had cleared off. He's going, yeah, all right. And doing the sort of Stones type riffs and things like,
Oh my
sort
God.
of nerdling around. And just for everyone, we were just laughing our heads off at this bloke. It was, oh, yeah, all right, yeah, love it, Prince, just fantastic.
That'd be a lot of fun. That'd be fun to see.
Yeah, and the talent that he had dwarfs anybody that's ever been in terms of musicality, in terms of the ability to play every instrument known to
And
man,
do the splits.
and do
And
the
do the
splits at the same
splits.
time as playing the guitar.
Which I've never been able to do at the same
Neither
time
have
as playing
I.
guitar.
But as I've said to Rebecca many, many times, it's what killed him in the end was, he had so many chronic pain problems from doing all those extreme dance moves. He became a Jehovah's Witness, so he couldn't have an operation to have his hips replaced. And he went on fentanyl, and that killed him.
Poor bloke.
Wow. I didn't know he was a Jehovah's Witness. That's new.
No,
I
I
didn't
didn't
realize
know
that.
that. Yeah, it was the latter years. I mean, a lot of his 80s music and early 90s stuff, very sexualized content. And then suddenly that all changes completely. And he becomes very much sort of, he became a Jehovah's Witness. And as a consequence, he wasn't allowed to have blood transfusions and therefore undergo major surgery, which is what he needed to cope with the pain. And he became another fentanyl victim.
That's such a shame.
Yeah, it's tragic. I mean, and it's something that I don't, this is my interpretation of it. They don't actually, no one's ever sort of come out and said, that's the connection, but I'm making the connection. And it's, as a journalist, it seems too obvious, He had a fentanyl addiction. He died of an overdose in his lift at Paisley Park. Body found 3 hours after he passed away, because he kept hours that no one else kept. So he had the run of the place at, late at night, gets in his own lift, having jacked up to cope with the pain.
Yeah.
Kills him.
We can't end on that note.
And on that note.
And on that note. The death of Prince.
Well, well, this is the nature of the Hobcast Book Show. It goes any which way. And, you know. Well, okay. Look, I mean, we're going to look forward very much to your book coming out.
Yeah, I'm definitely.
And you're having your podcast continues, or your podcasting. So yes. Tell us where people can find you and more about, your work and the various things that you creative things that you get up to.
Yes. So, yeah, the podcasting is continuing and things like that, which is fun. You can find me on social media. My handle is Luke Writes Crime pretty much everywhere. I mean, I have Threads, but I don't use it. I don't have Blue Sky. So basically Twitter and Threads and Instagram are all sort of there. But yeah, Luke Writes Crime will find me. I'm about to start a new podcast with author Matthew Booth called Mean Streets, a film noir podcast. You can find that now on pretty much anywhere, Apple, Spotify, YouTube. We have a trailer out. The first episode of that podcast drops later this month, April 2024. I think the 25th is the first episode, and it's I'll give you the exclusive. It's The Big Sleep. Humphrey Bogart's The Big Sleep is our first episode.
Oh, excellent.
Really excited. That one was a lot of fun to dive into. So yeah, for fans of film noir or cinema in general, go check that one out. Yeah. Because we're going to be pouring a lot of time into that podcast. I like doing The Secret Circle, but that's going to take a back step for a little while.
Sure.
As we plow ahead with this. So yeah, Luke Writes Crime will find me pretty much anywhere. And Mean Streets podcast is out there ready for subscribers.
Fantastic. Well, congratulations on that and everything else. And as ever, it's been a massive pleasure to speak to you.
Yeah. Thank you for having me on again. This was a lot of fun, and I enjoyed our tangents.
Long may they live on.
Indeed.
I'll be honest, I think Dr. Luke's name is perfect for a Star Trek character.
It's because there's a Luke Picard, isn't it?
Yeah, Jean-Luc Picard.
Yeah, so that's Luke why you're Deckard. Thinking. But we also know that he's a bit of a sci-fi geek.
Oh, absolutely,
Dr. Luke.
What you won't realise, listeners, is that his room is festooned with action figures and stuff like that. The sort of thing that I would love to have collected, but for some reason, I don't think I've ever been in a relationship where it would be sustained.
Really?
Yeah, the last 30 years, no. But I remember my love of figures when they first came out with Star Wars in 1977. Oh, my God, I was absolutely obsessed. I had a Han Solo, but I lost his gun. And after that, they're no value, really.
Well, as we sit, you can see my... it's not even a figurine. It's a toy of a cat from the 25th century, a Japanese cat with no ears.
Oh.
You see it? Doraemon.
Yes, I can, yes. I was always wondering what that was. Sat next to a picture of Luke, your eldest, when he was about, by the look of it,
five, I think he's in.
Really, is you little as that?
Yeah, something like that.
Well, he's just gone back to university.
I know.
I took my son back, James, last week, and I haven't heard back from him, but he had to play a game of rugby Friday night. He was dreading it, the last of the season. So I don't know what sort of shape he's in. Anyway, this week, we've got another moment in Hoback history. We are re-releasing.
Yeah, so we decided to re-release Her Deadly Friend by Rachel Sargent with a new cover and a new look to the series.
Yes.
And there are some changes in the series as well, because we've got the second book in the series, Her Charming Man, coming out next month. So if you get the chance, look at the covers, because we absolutely love them. We'd love to know what you think as well. And yes, that's quite exciting. We're re-releasing it. It's going to be 99p on ebook as a sort of re-release treat for you all.
Yeah, check it out. That's Her Deadly Friend by Rachel Sargent. And we are delighted to say that The Midnight Man, the copies of that arrived.
I know, in a big box. And I was so excited.
That's Julie Anderson's release, and that's coming out at the end of the month.
End of the month. So Julie is on our podcast next week.
Yeah.
To talk about The Midnight Man. I was actually just listening to Julie just before we started recording this. She's been on Crime Time FM.
With Paul Burke.
With Paul Burke. And if you get a chance to listen to that as well, she doesn't just talk about The Midnight Man. She talks about the Clapham Book Festival. She talks about her writing, both historical fiction and thrillers, and her time in Whitehall as well. So it's really interesting interview.
Listen to it after you've heard our interview with her next week.
That's like 2 hours of...
Yeah, the full stereo Julie experience. No, that'd be great. It's a terrific book. And again, a lot of buzz around it. So fantastic. God, I used that word too
fantastic
often. Yes, okay, we need to explain something. Last week I said I would mention you.
Hello.
You started the show like that. And that is because on Salvage Hunters on Discovery Plus, that is the way that our hero Drew Pritchard, when he returns from looking for antiques all around the UK, is greeted by his now ex-wife Rebecca with hello. And she always says,
it's fantastic. It's unbelievable. It's so amazing. It's going to sell so easily in the shop.
This is going to be a reference that passes people by.
I know, they've got no idea.
We're on series 10. I must admit my patience with it. I don't think I can take much more of it, if I'm honest.
You reluctantly watch it now.
I do. I enjoyed it to start with. But when you know that all the relationships in the show are going to fall apart in real life.
And Enzo is going to die.
We're in 2016 or something, so we've got a few years yet and they're still making them, no, it's not it's just not holding my interest now, I'm afraid. But you know, it passed the time during those long nights, but now we're getting longer days. It's fantastic. I've just been out for a walk and it is gorgeous out there today. Finally some warmth in the air.
Yes, we need our lawnmower back though.
Yeah, well that's coming back next week hopefully, but that's going to be a job. Yeah, the grass is about 4 foot high now. But anyway, so that's one of the jobs this week. And as I say, we're re-releasing Her Deadly Friend by Rachel Sargent. Sorry.
You're miles away for a second.
I was about to say another Rachel because, you know, I've been working very hard on a video release for Rachel McLean. That'll surface this week, hopefully.
There are too many Rachels in the world because I've also been working for someone called Rachel Reed. So if I say to you, I'm just doing this bit of work for Rachel, you don't know which Rachel I'm talking about.
No, I have no idea. I have no idea. But it keeps the wolves away. So thank you so much for joining us. Join us again for next week's show with Julie Anderson as our guest. But from myself, Adrian Hobart.
And myself, Rebecca Collins.
Thank you so much for joining us. And we wish you a wonderful and creative...
That's my word.
No, sorry. We wish you a wonderful and...
creative...
week. Fantastic. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Hobcast from Hoback Books with Adrian Hobart and Rebecca Collins. You can find the show notes at our website, www.hobeck.net. You can also use the exclusive Hobcast discount code for any of the products at our Hoback online store. Just enter the code HOBCAST20 for a 20% discount. Don't forget to subscribe to The Hobcast and feel free to contact us with any feedback. Until next time, remember our motto, Trad Values, Indie Spirit.